This is the chief thing we must aim at. Well-meaning people have often taken God's will into their own hands. Their attitude toward the patient has been, "Poor soul, it's time he went. The sooner the better for him." We must pray, and concentrate on him being taken quickly to save him further suffering, and so on. Their motive is good, but the result is that some part of the subconsciousness is aroused, that portion of it that has been labeled self-preservation, or the first law of nature, and which is always fighting to preserve its hold on the physical body. It is a very strong instinct indeed, as we realize when we remember the automatic action of raising one's arm to avoid a blow before we are consciously aware that there is anything to be avoided. The closing up of the eye to the invading fly or speck of dust. Instinct is not one of the highest attributes of our minds, but while we inhabit the earthly body, it is a very strong and insistent one. When death is near, it rouses itself at the slightest provocation, just when it is most important that the soul should go on its course of freedom, peacefully, and without hindrance, so we must aim at not giving it any provocation. The detached and impersonal attitude of the professional nurse, which sometimes strikes one as being unsympathetic and cold, is much to be preferred to some of the fussy, though well-meant attentions of fond and anxious relatives. The perfect condition, whenever circumstances permit, it would be that whoever is attending the patient should be someone who understands the mental and etheric side of death as well as the merely physical. The perfect program of behavior at such a time would be for this wise person to take entire charge. Probably it would be a woman, though what I have to say could just as easily apply to a man, but for our purpose I will refer to this person in the feminine gender. Her aims would be to think hopeful and encouraging thoughts toward the soul of the patient. If she cannot originate them, she can fall back for inspiration on some of the reassuring passages in the scriptures, or extracts from any good book on spiritual matters which contain references to the happier side of the change we call death. Any thoughts she can quietly, easily transmit will encourage and assist the soul in its efforts to liberate itself. Love will give the necessary understanding. How wonderful if we were to someday combine a course of spiritual training alongside the usual material side of a nurse's and doctor's training. I have known many women who look upon the work of nursing as a holy mission, and would welcome such a course. As Goebbels said, "There are in this loud, stunning tide of human care and crime, with whom the melodies abide of the everlasting chime. Who carry music in their heart through dusty lane and wrangling mart, plying their daily toil with busier feet because their secret souls a holy strain repeat." Yes, there are many who would fain carry the music in their hearts, and the holy strain to all who need it, and such a possession need not interfere with the practical common sense that is necessary for carrying out what are called the more practical, mundane side of nursing. We should find ourselves more easily able to ply the daily toil with busier feet in consequence of our spiritual knowledge. While we are awaiting this state of affairs, a balance of physical and spiritual knowledge in medicine and nursing, we must just do our best with the material to hand. It is wonderful how insight and intuition can spring from love, and teach the unskilled exactly what to do. Was not Longfellow right in saying, "Ah, how skillful grows the hand that obeyeth love's command, it is the heart and not the brain, that to the highest doth attain, and he who followeth love's behest far excelleth all the rest." So if you are not skilled nor clever nor experienced, you can still do so much, so very much, to make that passing a thing of beauty and of ease if you choose. Just the same quiet, careful attitude that you would adopt to a child who is learning to walk, or to essay any new task. The average soul is exactly in the position of a child in its relation to its new life. Remember, there are other souls waiting to help, souls who are already in the great beyond, and are even now waiting to assist the new arrival as soon as he frees himself. Loving hands are stretched out, beckoning the tired and weary soul to a place of peace, some sheltering shade where sin and striving cease, as Wordsworth said. We must cooperate with those unseen helpers. They long for us to do so, and if we lift up our hearts and minds in simple expectation, we shall find that they will impress us what to do for the best. He will give his angels charge over thee is literally true, especially in this critical period when the two states we call life and death draw so near to one another that for a short time we can scarcely perceive the dividing borderline. Toward the end of my husband's last week on earth, I was sitting alone with him. He had fallen into one of those easy, peaceful dozes to which he had been a stranger for so long. I had given him drinks of water, put through a small filter, and very little solid food. He persistently reminded me not to press food on him, but to give him more water. This was very unlike him, because, as I remarked before, he liked food and strong tea, he disliked water by itself. I also followed my impressions with regard to not talking about him, or about other things in the room, but talking to him whenever advisable. Sometimes I just sat quietly by his side, saying nothing, but thinking to him. I am sure this is the most helpful attitude toward a dying person that we can adopt, viz. Talking quietly and hopefully to him whenever it is evident that he wishes, or is able to listen, and when he cannot do so, one should choose one's thoughts carefully. There is little doubt that the lucent soul picks up and reacts to every thought in its environment. It becomes increasingly sensitive to thoughts until the final severance, when it is usually quietly taken away by those others who have come to help with that purpose in view. As I sat and watched, he awoke and stretched out his hand, reaching for mine. In a feeble but distinct voice he said, "I have been again to that beautiful place, but I don't want to go to it without you. I didn't know I had to go there alone." In all my life, those were the most sad and difficult words to which I ever had to listen. I sat speechless, realizing that at last the spirit friends and helpers over there had broken the dread news to my husband that he had to go to the new and beautiful country alone, leaving me behind. He had always disliked leaving me even for a day. And now he had been told that he must leave me and make his home alone, in this other place. Again he spoke. "I want to stay with you. These other people are very kind to me. They are all right to me, but I don't want to go alone and leave you. Can't I stay with you, darling? I don't want to stay with them without you." I did not know what to say. The words came pleadingly from his lips. His hand feebly clung to mine. His face turned toward me, eyes too tired to open wide, but trying so hard to look at my face, and read there the answer to his question. A sharp, swift prayer shot straight from my heart, asking for help, guidance, as to what I should say to him. He was begging for my assurance that we should not be parted, but how could I tell him a reassuring lie? A lie, in these last solemn, sacred hours? George Eliot's words came to my mind. What greater thing is there for two human souls than to feel that they are joined for life, to strengthen each other in all labor, to rest on each other in all sorrow, to minister to each other in all pain, to be one with each other in silent, unspeakable memories at the moment of the last parting. So how could I smirch those memories with evasion or deliberate untruth? Strength and courage came back to me, and I answered, "If you have to go alone, remember it will only be for a little while. Some day I shall go, too, and join you, and in the meantime you will be able to keep in touch with me, and I shall try and live on here in the manner you would wish. Hold hard to the thought that even if you are going first, I shall follow you later, whenever it is the right time." He did not answer, neither did he refer to it again. Chapter 9. The Last Hours. That same evening, being Saturday, nurse was off duty, and we had the help of a sympathetic little woman who sometimes came in for that one night each week, so that I could rest downstairs. Seeing my husband was asleep, I left her in charge, and went down to my study, where a temporary bed had been made up for me. I undressed and got into bed, but could not sleep. Quite distinctly I received the strongest impression to get up and go back to my husband that his time was now very short, so I must make the most of every minute, and help him all I could. Against this impression was the fact that we had all been preparing ourselves for the possibility of having to wait some time longer, because of his easier physical condition. Yet, on the other hand, we felt it might be fairly soon, because of the increased weakness. I resisted the impulse to get up again, remembering that only that day the nurse had implored me to rest, and save myself up for the time when I should really be wanted, and when I should need all my strength. But after a few minutes' indecision, again came the impression, just as if a voice was speaking within my brain, yet it had come from some other, outside source. Get up. Go to him at once, we will tell you how to help him. So I put on my dressing gown, and went straight up to the bedroom. I asked the friend who attended him to go downstairs and rest while I looked after my husband. The only reason I gave was that I could not sleep. Somewhat surprised, she obeyed me, and I was left alone. My husband slept, but not a very easy sleep. It was fitful, as if broken into by a half-consciousness of physical discomfort. His breathing was irregular and labored. I knelt down quickly, and asked that those spirit helpers who were around us would be allowed to impress me with whatever could be done to help him. As I rose, I remembered that the doctor had that day suggested to the nurse that she might give her patient an enema. It was not an instruction, merely a suggestion. Nurse, knowing how he hated it, had not given it, as she had not wanted to disturb and worry him, especially as it was her weekly night off, and she knew I should have to deal with any disagreeablenesses that arose afterwards. Also, as he had eaten no solid food for some days, there seemed very little necessity for it. Now I suddenly felt that I had to give him an injection, but not an enema of the usual soap and water. I was impressed to get some olive oil, and slightly warm it, and I injected about a quarter of a pint of this with an ordinary glass rectum syringe. I achieved this with no trouble whatever, and without waking the patient. The result of this injection was remarkable, and I had all my work cut out dealing with it alone. One would have thought he had been living on solid food in large quantities up to the present moment. I must mention here that for 6 long, weary months he had been unable to lie on his back, or on his right side, owing to a large lump on the lower part of his spine, slightly toward the right side. It had been terribly tiring, only being able to rest on the left side all this long time. The slightest pressure in any other direction, or attempt to lie in any other position, gave him intolerable agony. I felt my hands being drawn towards his body, and almost before I realized what it was I had to do, I was making upward passes from his feet to his head, or rather, past his head. My hands felt as if they were charged with a kind of magnetic current, which increased as I repeated the passes, which merely consisted of placing my hands, palms downwards, a few inches above his feet, and moving them steadily and rhythmically over the legs and body, and straight over his head. At the finish of each pass I flipped my fingers in a direction away from his body, as if I was throwing off something from my fingertips. Afterwards I learned that these passes were assisting the etheric body to leave the physical body more easily. It withdraws upwards, through the head. While I was completing the passes, which only took about 5 minutes, I noticed that my husband's breathing altered. The labored, painful sound ceased. He gave a deep sigh, apparently of relief, and to my intense surprise, raised himself, as if possessed of his full normal strength, up from his left side, and deliberately settled himself on his back, a feat which, as I have already explained, had been impossible for 6 months. Was so glad. It was such a relief to see him once more in this natural position. I looked anxiously for the first sign that the position was becoming painful, but none came. He just breathed easily and peacefully, and awoke at intervals when I gave him drinks of water and the juice and pulp of sweet black grapes alternately. From then onwards his condition was one of absolute peace. I prayed over and over again that he would not again refer to the question of going alone to the other place, and he did not mention it. He scarcely spoke at all, but smiled slightly when I gave him the grape juice or water. Though he was only semi-conscious, it was evident that he needed water. Even when he appeared to be unconscious, and I was a little nervous as to whether he could swallow while in that condition, I still persisted, and gave the water, a few drops at a time, in a teaspoon, to which I could feel his lips cling greedily, though he was motionless in every other way. It seemed as if he could not get enough of it, and I feel convinced from my own experiences, and from what other people have told me, that the dying need water, but are often physically incapable of asking for it. Water is the one thing that the etheric body can make use of when trying to free itself from the physical at the approach of death of the latter. The next day, a Sunday, passed quietly in this manner. One or two of his relatives came in, but only stayed a short time, so I was able to hold peaceful, encouraging thoughts over him all the time. The hours did not drag. I seemed to live half on the earth, and half on another plane, where I felt I was mentally cooperating with the unseen helpers who were in the room, though invisible. I kept my patient's feet warm with a hot electric pad, carefully regulated and wrapped up so that it could not burn, or become uncomfortably hot. Warmth of the feet, and a comfortable coolness, not cold or draft, at the head seems to facilitate the withdrawal of the etheric body, either temporarily during normal sleep, or near death, but especially in the latter case. Late that evening, when nurse came on duty again, she begged me to go down again and get a good night's sleep, so as to reserve my strength for when it should be needed, as she again reminded me. I felt that the time was very near for the passing, and very reluctantly I went downstairs, and, as on the previous night, I was not surprised to again get the strong impression to return to my husband. He wanted me, I felt sure. Yet I hesitated. Was I being foolish, using up my strength unnecessarily, as nurse said? I fought the impulse to go back to him for over half an hour. Then again it came so forcibly I could no longer resist it. I arose, and went straight up to my husband's room. I entered very quietly, wearing soft slippers. He could not see me, as there was a large screen between the door and the head of the bed, but to my intense surprise, he raised himself up on one arm, almost to a sitting position, and urgently signed to me to come near to him. He said my name, urgently, imploringly. I went close to him and said, "Yes, I'm here. Do you want anything?" He replied, "Yes, yes, tell her," pointing in the direction of the nurse, "tell her." "What shall I tell her?" I asked. Even more urgently, almost frantically, his voice hoarse and strained with the effort, he again said, "Tell her, tell her." His voice failed, but with his right hand still extended, he made a circular movement in the air several times. Then he fell back exhausted, but still conscious. I could not imagine what it was he wanted me to tell the nurse, so I just said, "Never mind, whatever you want you shall have. Don't worry, I shall guess or find out soon, I feel sure." While I was speaking, my hand went out, from force of habit, to the drinking water on the table near the bed, and I gave him some. He drank, and immediately after gave a deep sigh of satisfaction. A long ah and the tense, anxious look was replaced by a smile of relief. I then realized that I had not impressed nurse with the need for constant sips of water, and the explanation of the circular motion of his hand burst upon me, and I remembered that whenever he had wished for a certain drinking cup with a spout which I had lately bought him, and was very easy to drink from in small quantities without spilling, he used to say, "Give me a drink in the you know my," and rather impatiently he would describe these circles in the air with his hand. So I realized that while I was downstairs he had wanted water, and had made these gestures, which had of course conveyed nothing to the nurse. For the moment I had myself forgotten what they meant. He had thought I had only come up again for a few moments, and was afraid I was going away again until the morning, and that he would not be able to get the water he so badly needed. I told him I was not going to leave him at all, and I lay down for the rest of the night on a divan in the room, but did not sleep. All night long nurse and I gave him drinks of water. She was afraid that he could not swallow, but I felt I should quickly see when it came to that point, and she told me to get a clean linen handkerchief, and dip a small part of it in water, and let him suck it, which he did later the next day, when drinking from the spouted cup or spoon had become obviously impossible. I had noticed that his mouth was terribly sore inside, so I thoroughly mixed equal parts of honey and glycerin together, slightly thinning them with a little water, as the cold weather had made the honey very thick, and I applied this on another linen handkerchief spread over my finger to the roof of his mouth and all round his gums. This was a great relief to him, I could see. It is important not to use ordinary rags, no matter how nice and clean they may be, for either swabbing the mouth or giving the drinking water, as small threads or pieces of cotton might come off in the mouth and cause intense discomfort. Most of the next day he took the water and the grape juice. In the afternoon nurse looked in as a precaution, but saw her patient peacefully sleeping, so went away again, intending to return later in the evening, as usual. Soon after she left, he woke and said distinctly, "This is a lovely place," and a great joy spread over his face. I knew he had just come back from the other place again. These were the last actual words he spoke. One of my husband's nieces came in about 3 o'clock, and sat watching beside his bed while I lay down on the divan. Curiously enough, I was not tired, though I had had no sleep for some days, and very little before then. About 3:30 we made some tea, and I again took my usual seat close to the bed. I poured out the tea for my niece and myself, but before we had finished the first cup, I noticed that a scarcely perceptible, yet definite change had come over my husband. Indeed, the change had come into the room, not only over him. What is this strange something that so many people feel just before the soul is ready to depart? Tangible, yet intangible. Mysterious, yet unmistakable, and convincing in its reality. I realized the time had come. I knew also that he did not want to go and leave me. I talked quietly, softly, to him. Self-consciousness, that stranglehold on so many of our natural expressions of love and sympathy, left me. I knew his niece was beside me, but I also knew that she would understand. So I told him to go willingly and peacefully to the beautiful place, where he would be safe, and free from all pain and discomfort, to go gladly away with those loved ones who had passed through the same gateway, to go where he would be nearer to God in very truth, and to live and wait in that lovely land which God's mercy had allowed him to visit during these last sad, yet wonderful days, that place which seems so strangely familiar. The place where we shall see the smiling angel faces which we have loved long since and lost a while, that the hymn tells us will meet us with the dawn of a new life. I said nothing original or brilliant to him, only the same old simple truths that well up from the very depths of our being when we face the deep and real aspects of existence. I held his hand. His features relaxed. He smiled faintly and without the slightest difficulty. Not even a fluctuation in his breathing, it simply ceased. I still sat on for a while, encouraging him, giving him comfort and hope, so that he would not feel that the actual and definite leaving of the physical envelope had made any difference to my consciousness of his existence. This, I think, is important. It is unwise to pour out prayer, comfort and love previous to the passing, and the moment it occurs, to break off abruptly, feeling this is the end. Few people really think that the shedding of the physical means the end of existence. It is the idea that the end of one volume has been reached, and the next is so inscrutable and mysterious that it is impossible to penetrate any further. There are things to be done, physical, necessary things to be seen to at once. So on with other physical duties. This is wrong. Even though love and sense of duty actuate it, it is wrong. The first moments immediately following the dissolution should be made as helpful to the departing soul as were the moments preceding it. Chapter 10. Fear of being buried alive. For a little while I must leave the personal side of my narrative, and refer to some important aspects of death, and our present methods of disposing of the physical body. People who are exhausted by severe pain, or die as the result of an accident, or are entirely ignorant of the possibility of survival, drift into a state of unconsciousness on leaving the physical body. They probably remain in this condition while their friends take them away from the earth plane and for some time afterwards. Others may be conscious, as and after they vacate the physical, and look down at what is happening, and on the people they are about to leave. Undue grief, which is always the outcome of ignorance regarding the facts of immortality, is to be avoided, because it must necessarily agitate the one who looks on, powerless to alleviate until he is himself established in his new condition, yet knows he is the cause of the very sorrow he longs to assuage. He may be drawn back to his earthly body by his desire to help. Remember, the silver cord which binds the etheric to the physical is not yet broken, and the length of this cord, or as Mr. Head Carrington calls it, astral cable, can sometimes be shortened or lengthened at will. Those who have acquainted themselves with all the available evidence and facts relating to survival, and have systematically tried to live their earthly lives in accordance with divine law and principles of truth, love and service, often find themselves conscious of all that is happening during the actual transition from one body to another, and afterwards. However, we must not forget that the etheric body is subject to certain mental and physical laws, just as the earthly body is, and that a sudden death by accident, for instance, may give the etheric body such a shock as will render it unconscious for a time, no matter how evolved and perfect the individual soul may be. This subjection to certain physical laws only lasts while the etheric cord is intact. There may be some isolated cases where the manner of death, such as being blown to pieces by a shell or other explosion, may immediately cut it. I have no doubt whatever that the cutting of an artery would sever the cord, and if a body had to be buried or cremated at short notice, or before definite signs of dissolution have shown themselves, it should always be done. Indeed, I would go so far as to suggest that it should be done in every case, not immediately after death, as we call it, has apparently taken place, that is when breathing ceases, but at the last possible moment, before the final rites of fastening down the lid of the coffin, etc., have to be carried out. In the majority of cases of death from natural causes, I believe that the cord wears gradually thinner and thinner, as the individual life and consciousness become more firmly established in the etheric body, usually about the third or fourth day after the death, from the medical point of view, has occurred, the cord has become so attenuated, it simply breaks its last weak thread, and what happens afterwards to the physical body does not materially affect the etheric counterpart at all. I am afraid, and I know I am in danger of arousing a good deal of controversy, that the new methods now in vogue of keeping a corpse as lifelike as possible, in order to make it look pleasant and normal to the bereaved relatives, is not conducive to an early breaking of the etheric cord. Whatever the method used, if it succeeds in keeping the physical body intact, it means that a certain amount of the etheric force is being retained. Now, the etheric cord, or astral cable, is the medium used for conveying the life force to the body during its earthly existence, and whatever conduces to the retention of this force after death must necessarily maintain the existence of the etheric cord. It cannot be retained indefinitely, it is true. Probably it is only possible to retain it at all for a slightly longer period than would normally be the case, but however short it is, it adds to the danger that the soul may be aware of what happens in the disposing of the physical body, either through burial or cremation. On one occasion I saw a body which had obviously been treated in this way, and I realized psychically that the soul was still connected to it by the cable. I took steps to ensure being alone with it for a time, and prayed for help and inspiration to be given me to break the cord. As I knelt, I sensed the presence of certain discarnate beings, who were obviously there to help, among them being three men who were doctors when on earth. I have often been told that doctors are naturally drawn to the special work of assisting in the birth of the individual into spirit life, just as they had often helped new lives to be born into physical life. It is very much the same process, being born into a new state of consciousness, whether earthly or etheric. I addressed these three doctors by name, telling them I would do whatever they impressed me to do. After waiting a moment or so longer, I felt impelled to make the same passes that I had used in my husband's case, before he died, and while concentrating firmly on the cord being severed, I made several passes along the body, which lay in the open coffin ready for burial the following day, from the feet towards the head, but after the first two or three movements I instinctively started them from a point higher than in my husband's case. I found myself impressed to start in the region of the solar plexus, and continued them well beyond the head. Many authorities state that the astral body is joined by the cord to the head of the physical body. Yes, I think this is so, but from certain experiences of my own, I believe there is also a connection of some kind. Exactly what, I don't understand yet, with the solar plexus,